It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get another perspective on the news that more Wisconsin teachers have lost their jobs since Act 10 became law.
But first, we're talking about how email is swallowing our lives. Rob?
Yeah, it's a I feel like I'm always fighting a losing battle there. I'm up at, I think, 1,200 some in my inbox, and, you know, you pick away at it, but what do you do? Anyway, our guest looked at several studies on email use at the office, talked to some experts about how much time we're spending on email. Short version, it's bad. It's really bad.
Jennifer Senior joins us. She's contributing editor at New York Magazine. Welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So how much time is the average worker really spending just trying to manage their email?
Well, the best number I found is that it's 28% of their time. So if you assume a 40-hour work week, which most people don't work, you know, they do more of that, but let's be conservative and say 40 hours, assuming they're employed full time, 11.2 hours a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
that's more than a day.
It's more than 2 hours a day. And it doesn't include something that I thought was really interesting. A fellow also looked at, this is one of the founders of Sanebox, which helps you manage your email and filter them. He found that each email takes about 67 seconds to recover from, which I think does stand to reason intuitively. I mean, there is a certain head of steam that you get going, you're working on a project, and then your inbox pings, and you're diverted, and you have to deal with it, and it could take a long. And he's not talking about the amount of time that you spend replying to the email. He's talking about the amount of time that you spend disengaging and then re-engaging, the kind of where was I stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you consider that you kind of contend with about 75 emails a day coming into your inbox and multiply that by 67 seconds per email, that's an additional hour and 20 minutes or so per day. So it comes out to nearly 4 hours a day that you're kind of contending with emails in some way or another.
But it's all really important stuff, right?
No. I think, the industry consensus seems to be somewhere around the 40% mark, 42% mark, that those are the ones that are considered important. And, you know, they can range from, you know, your spouse saying, we need bread and pick it up on the way home, to something from your boss. And then a lot of it is, just stuff you can table. You were mentioning like 1,200 emails sitting in your inbox, and maybe that's the 60% that you've, been accumulating.
A lot of it is, but it feels like you've got to pay close attention to that email, because maybe there's something important, some grain in the chaff there, or somebody's going to be really ticked off at me if I don't give their email the proper attention and reply that it so richly deserves.
Yeah, exactly. There was a Harvard Business School professor whose name escapes me at the moment, but of course it will come to me in 10 seconds, who talked about the cycle of responsiveness, that the problem is that we're all kind of condemned to answer our emails very quickly if you're in a culture where everyone answers their emails very quickly. So if your bosses are in the habit of getting emails back very quickly from, four of the employees that they work with, and you're the one who actually is civilized about it and eats their lunch first, for instance, it can be a problem. I mean, it can be a real problem.
Do you have a sense of how much email the average employee is receiving that isn't spam?
Spam is a really low percentage. It's something like, I'd have to look it up, but it's not more than about 10 or 12%. I mean, most of the emails are not spam. They just wouldn't necessarily be deemed essential. You know, they're things that can wait. And that I would suspect, although I don't have any, I don't think anybody's done a controlled study that looks at this, but that I would suspect are more quickly dispensed with a phone call. Also, a lot of these things are useless CCs. You're kind of, you're being notified, but you don't really need to look at these things.
So it seems like there's a few categories here. There's the really important stuff that we're glad we got, want to reply to it. There's stuff that we can kind of delete on site.
Yep.
I think for a lot of people, you wrote about, and in my life, the big problem is that middle ground. Like, that's probably important. It would probably benefit me to read that, but I don't need to do it right now. And that's where the inbox builds up. Has anybody come up with a system to tackle that and to deal with that sort of sludge that slowly builds up?
Yep. There are a bunch of companies that do that. And, you can sign up for their services. You can, do some of it online. What winds up happening is that some people use color coding so that you can, kind of rate your emails. I mean, to me, it seems very intimidating because I don't want to spend any more time. I don't want to spend time thinking about categorizing my emails, but I'm sure if I ever bothered to plug myself into a system, it would be more efficient. I mean, you know, there's this whole movement to get to zero inbox, and this is the way they do it. You know, you color code your what's flowing in. There are some systems you can sort of you can enable that will kind of that will stagger your emails, so you don't get them every time they land. You get them at 3-hour intervals or at 2-hour intervals or at the end of the day, however you want to do it. So yes, there are technologies that can do this for you. I don't want to name them now because that's kind of plugging one particular company. But yes, there's no shortage of them out there.
Well, I'm sure there are some behavioral things we could do on our own, too. First of all, maybe changing our mentality, our attitude about email.
I think that's totally true. I think also, just based on the comment thread from my post, from my essay about this, a lot of people talk about the fact that their bosses have kind of these outsized expectations. So my suspicion, in a way, is that employers have to also change the way that they think about this, that they can't consider it, you know, a fireable offense if someone at 7:45 does not respond to an email. You know, the implicit assumption can't be that it's the same as a phone call. You know, if you want to speak to somebody immediately, you probably should phone them.
And that's another point. Either I can't remember if it was you or you quoted somebody raising your book or in your article. We have this alternative technology out there that works better than email for a lot of things, and that's the phone. Have we gotten scared of just picking up the darn phone?
Yeah, I think that the Times wrote a very funny piece about this a few years ago, and I've just noticed a change within my own profession. I don't know if it's true where you are, but my workplace is almost completely silent because no one approaches anybody by phone anymore. They don't make cold calls. They email. So if somebody's doing an interview, it's probably, you know, the exception. Most of our correspondence is, you know, online now. So, I mean, it's very strange, and it probably would behoove us to do it. You did see that in my story. What I said is that if Martians landed on our planet, they would, you know, probably be convinced that we invented email first and not the phone, because email is the much less efficient instrument.
Yeah, I've often come off the end of an email thread where you email and email back and forth, and realize for all the time that took, it would have taken about 40 seconds on the phone.
Exactly.
To convey all the same info.
No, it, exactly. I mean, like, kind of the idiotic back and forthing that you do over which restaurant and where. And I mean, it's crazy. Exactly.
But by doing it that way, Rob, I'm wondering if you felt at the time that you were being more efficient because mm-hmm. while you were emailing, you were working on another project, let's say. And how much does that multitasking mentality, Jennifer, play into this?
Well, here's the problem. We're not meant to multitask. You know, we are not very efficient at task switching as a species. So it's probably true that you had some false sense that you were being more productive, but you're not really. I mean, we are kind of neurologically designed not to focus on seven things, even though we can do it. So I think that's fake in a way and sort of misleading.
So you had reference too. We hear a ping, and then all of a sudden we drop everything we're doing to go see what that email was. I imagine that one way around that is to turn off your alerts. What other tips do you have for cutting down on the distractions?
I think boundaried hours. You know, that after 6:30, you're not doing this anymore. You know, you're disabling. Some people suggest also that certain rooms are dedicated to work and others are not, but that, like, absolutely no electronic devices at all can be brought into the living room or the dining room. That's one that I haven't yet successfully kind of done within my own family. And, of course, I don't do it, so why would I expect anyone else to do it? But it is a very sane policy. So there's another.
Do you see a cultural backlash in workplaces around the country saying, hey, we're wasting too much time on email, we need to change our expectations?
No. but I'm not really an office ethnographer. But I mean, this isn't the only thing that I write about. And I wonder, you know, if you would start to see that. But any time I've ever spoken to anybody who talks about corporate culture, no. It's always the opposite. It's still an emphasis on acceleration, not deceleration. So, no, I don't see that.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jennifer Senior, contributing editor at New York Magazine.
Coming up next, we're going to get another perspective on a story we touched on yesterday. More teachers have lost their jobs since Act 10 became law in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yesterday, we spoke to an attorney with the Wisconsin Education Association Council about news from the Oshkosh Northwestern that school districts are letting go of more teachers since Act 10 passed.
Act 10 was part of the controversial budget bill passed a couple years back. It ended collective bargaining rights for most public sector unions in Wisconsin, including teacher unions.
Our guest said teachers are losing their jobs without just cause since Act 10 became law. Now we'll get a different perspective on this story. We're talking to Barry Forbes, Associate Executive Director and Staff Counsel for the Wisconsin Association of School Boards. Barry, welcome to Central Time.
Well, hello.
So is it fair to say that more teachers are being fired since Act 10?
Well, I think it's important first to define what we're talking about when we say fired. Teachers in Wisconsin receive one-year contracts, individual teaching contracts. And, you know, it is possible that employment from one of those contracts might be terminated during the contract term. And I don't think that's what we're talking about here. Typically, we'd be talking about not renewing those contracts. So the teacher would get to complete that contract and then would not be invited to come back the next school year. And in response to your question, are there more of those non-renewals than there used to be? I think the answer would be yes, but with a big proviso. And that proviso would be that most of those non-renewals are for teacher layoff purposes.
Explain that a little bit.
Okay. Before Act 10, layoffs were governed by collective bargaining agreements, and the collective bargaining agreements would specify the procedures under which a teacher would receive a notice of layoff and be laid off from his or her employment. And those teachers would actually receive their individual teaching contracts, so there would not be a non-renewal.
Mm-hmm.
Act 10 prohibits bargaining over layoff clauses and most other wage, hour, and working conditions. And because of that prohibition, a school district that simply needs to employ fewer teachers for economic reasons must now use the non-renewal process to not employ those teachers in the next school year.
Is that is that legal? Is it fair?
Is that legal and fair? Yes, absolutely. And mm-hmm. There needs to be a mechanism where a school district that or any employer that needs to reduce staff can do so. And there always has been a mechanism. It used to be the collective bargaining layoff procedure. Now it is the statutory non-renewal process.
So, and we talked to a guest yesterday from WEAC who said that teachers that would never be subjected to termination under just cause standards before are now being let go. Do you think that non-renewals are being handed out fairly? And do you think that the standards are clear to teachers?
Yes, I think the non-renewal process is fair. And those comments probably address two separate sets of concerns that teachers and the unions might have, and they're both important considerations. Under those layoff provisions, layoffs were typically done on the basis of seniority, meaning that the least senior teachers would be laid off first, the more senior teachers would be protected. And following Act 10, school districts could adopt different criteria for selecting teachers for layoffs, such as the quality of their evaluations or the other needs of the school district. And that is a change that results in perhaps different teachers being non-renewed for economic purposes following Act 10 than were laid off before Act 10. And that's probably the bigger set, but there are also teachers that were or are being non-renewed or otherwise asked to leave employment with school districts because of their performance or conduct. And that is not a layoff. That would be more traditionally what we might think of as a termination of employment. And those teachers were most of those teachers were covered by just cause provisions before Act 10. Before Act 10, collective bargaining agreements typically would apply a just cause standard after a teacher was employed by a school district for 2 or 3 years. While they were before they during their first 2 or 3 years of employment, school district had a much greater degree of latitude to non-renew a teacher's contract in that pre-Act 10 world. Following Act 10, school districts set the standards for the non-renewal of teachers' contracts. And teachers, of course, are not without other legal protections. There are employment discrimination laws and other employment laws that effectively require that school districts have a good reason for why they're non-renewing a teacher's contract. But I would agree with what I imagine the union representatives told you yesterday, that that is not the same thing as just cause protection, and school districts would have an easier time non-renewing a teacher for their performance or conduct than they have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense for what kind of feedback teachers are getting before they receive that non-renewal and whether or not the non-renewals are coming as a surprise?
Teachers are required to be evaluated by law, and that's one of those employment protections that I was referring to earlier. If a teacher has not been evaluated and then suddenly finds himself or herself non-renewed, he or she might rightly object to the non-renewal based on the lack of the evaluation. And there have been court cases like that in the past, and school districts have policies governing those evaluation processes, and the courts have said that once a school district adopts a policy, that the school district is expected to follow that policy until it changes it. So the idea that a teacher would be so totally surprised by a non-renewal, I do not believe that to be the case. If a school district's evaluation process is functioning properly, they should know what their supervisors think of them through the evaluation process.
Mm-hmm. Has Act 10 helped school districts manage their payroll budget more efficiently?
It certainly has given school districts flexibility to do some things that we were unable to do before Act 10.
Like what?
The selection of teachers to be laid off is a great example where we can choose to lay teachers off based on the needs of the district. And just as an example, a teacher with multiple skills and certifications may not be the that was a less senior teacher may have been laid off in the past and might not be laid off under a school district's current layoff standards.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that Act 10 helps ensure teacher quality by making it easier to let go of teachers for performance reasons?
Well, the school districts are, the teachers were all responsible for the teacher quality. And Act 10 gives the school administration and board some tools that we did not have in the past.
So what are teachers saying about the employment landscape since Act 10?
I'm probably not the best person to ask.
Well, let me ask you this. In an ideal world, teachers who've proven themselves would have job security, perhaps like tenure, so that they are free to teach without maybe fear of information and modes of education being penalized. Is that an important provision for a healthy educational environment?
I think that giving school boards and school administration some latitude over the staff that they use to carry out our educational mission is just as important as that academic freedom argument. And there is just a great deal that is expected of school districts across America right now, and accountability and assessment seem to be the watchwords. And if we're going to be accountable, and if we're going to be expected to compete with the private and the voucher and the charter schools, which school districts increasingly are, we need that ability to field the best, most qualified staff we can.
Thanks, Barry, for being with us. That was Barry Forbes, Associate Executive Director and Staff Counsel for the Wisconsin Association of School Boards.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the author of a new book about how to be brave. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after four, Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss joins us for our Geek Out segment. We'll talk about a debate about women in the geek fan communities.
Our next guest writes about courage. She interviewed war veterans, firefighters, survivors of massacres, and others to find the meaning of bravery. Polly Moreland joins us now. She's a documentary maker, and her new book is The Society of Timid Souls, or How to Be Brave. Polly, welcome to the show.
Hi, Cynthia. Good to be with you.
Well, in your documentary career, you've investigated war crimes in the former Yugoslavia, gone into rebel territory in the jungles of Colombia. I would think that of you as a fairly courageous person. Is that how you would describe yourself?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because, you know, I probably among my friends, but there would be a few of them who do desk jobs in London and think, oh, wow. Polly must be brave going off to those places. But I must say that through really quite a long career in television, I never have felt brave. And while I have made programs about people who are living in very extreme, sometimes dangerous situations, or people who've done, you know, truly courageous or at least daring things, I've never felt like I quite got to the bottom of what their bravery was about. And I certainly was very mindful of how terrifying I sometimes found these edgier situations in which I sometimes found myself. And I suppose that's where that's in some sense where this journey began for me, was trying to understand a bit more about it and trying to understand whether some of these brave people were fundamentally different from me and perhaps didn't feel the anxiety and fears and worries that really seemed to plague me in my everyday life.
Mm-hmm. What got you first interested in taking a closer look at courage?
Well, I suppose it was this sense that I'd come very close to looking at it in all sorts of professional situations without ever quite asking the key questions, because I was there to cover the news agenda, or I was there to cover the kind of war agenda, or I was there to look at some other aspects of these stories. And I suppose there was a kind of clinching, so there was a dissatisfaction in me and this sense that I perhaps lacked a bit of courage myself, that had rumbled along in the background for a long time. And then one day, you know, a little over 3 years ago, I stumbled upon this old news story. And it was a news story that really changed my life. It was about this eccentric and radical group for stage fright and music that convened on the Upper West Side in Manhattan a little over 70 years ago. And they were called the Society of Timid Souls. And together, in their own small way, they'd learned to be brave. And what they did really was under the tutelage of a concert pianist called Bernard Gabriel, they used a form of kind of rudimentary exposure therapy to both confront their fears and to learn and practice mechanisms for overcoming them. In this very small and sweet and charming story that was long forgotten, this story, and then I'd stumbled upon it, and it kind of turned into something of an obsession for me. And there were two reasons it so caught my imagination. One was the kind of timing of the thing, because the Society of Timid Souls first met within just a couple of weeks of Pearl Harbor in the moment that America joined World War II. And I suppose what I found myself wondering was how those big fears that come with troubling times
Right.
They often trigger, you know, tiny terrified ripples and other little crises of courage. And I suppose I saw a parallel between their age of anxiety and our own. So they ended up being the kind of inspiration to set off and try and find out a bit more about what courage is and what it means.
So how exactly did they go about this? I think you called it exposure therapy.
Well, there are a handful of newspaper and magazine reports from the time that describe what to all intents and purposes sounds kind of comical. So the exposure therapy worked around, it was focusing on stage fright, and it worked around a process of being kind of heckled or disturbed or stared at or distracted in a variety of ways whilst playing the piano or singing your song or practicing your speech. And this would be done in a very kind of, in a closed, soundproofed room. Where the only other people there were the other timid souls in the society, but they would all gather and sort of, if you like, turn on each other and embody each other's fears of what was most terrifying in a performance situation, and this process of being exposed to the thing that terrified them went a good distance to, in some sense, curing them of their stage fright. And in subsequent years, in psychology through the 1970s, exposure therapy became gained some kind of clinical validity and was used in all sorts of circumstances. But back in the 1940s on the Upper West Side in New York, this was very outré. This was very outlandish and kind of radical thing to do. And so I suppose, for me, it keyed into a kind of core fascination with the questions of courage and how courageous people do courageous things, which was, I was very particularly interested in their relationship with their fears and their own, if you like, acquired mechanisms for overcoming those fears. And I guess that was what I read in this story of the Society of Timid Souls, and that was then what I went on to explore through a variety of situations, you know, many of them far more extreme than stage fright.
But in the scenario that you just described, they're having to perform in front of a group of friends. I would imagine that at this point they've become friends. Mm. And so even if they're acting out the greatest terror, are they taking it as seriously as if it were a stranger? You know, if they were performing in a concert hall in an actual anonymous audience that they've never met before, starts throwing tomatoes or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think perhaps like lots of forms of exposure therapy, it's a slightly softer version. Mm-hmm. To start off with, but I think there's a process of concentrating through these disturbances and distractions, and that feeling of everyone looking at you. Well, you know, whether it's a friendly audience or a hostile audience. I mean, I think it may seem a glib comparison, but it's quite an interesting one. That if you look at how soldiers are drilled for war zones. They are drilled through a process of ever more realistic battle drills that start with the quite mild and that grow and grow and grow until I spent a great deal of time with some British Army infantrymen who were about to deploy to Afghanistan, and the kind of final stage of their training was a kind of set-piece military exercise where, you know, kind of fake Afghan villages had been set up and, you know, with livestock and fruit markets and real Afghan villages, and that then highly realistic scenario was used as their kind of final preparation for war, but that they'd stepped their way up from milder, less realistic scenarios in order to in a way, the phrase the commanding officer used was a process of battle inoculation, where you would become to some extent immunized to the things that were most terrifying about that situation. And strangely, this word of inoculation is also one that was used by Bernard Gabriel, who led the Society of Timid Souls. He talked about stress inoculation, mm-hmm. About giving administering a dose of antitoxin, he said, that would to some extent immunize these frightened performers against their fears. So I suppose I look to trace this this process of stress immunization through a kind of wide range of different kind forms of courage.
Well, you talked to some more veterans, and I'll ask you about some of those conversations and the lessons you learned after we take a break and check the latest headlines. We're talking to Polly Moreland about her book, The Society of Timid Souls, or How to Be Brave.
And you can join in with your thoughts and questions about courage. Who for you is an example of bravery? Real person or fictional? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Polly Moreland is with us, and we're talking about her new book, The Society of Timid Souls, or How to Be Brave.
You can join in if you have questions or thoughts about what it means to be courageous, or an example, somebody you look to as an example of bravery. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234.
Polly, you talked to war veterans from World War II and soldiers who had served in Afghanistan. What did you learn from them about courage?
I mean, I think it's a lot, I should say, but in the first instance. I think there's one very strong thread that came through about the nature of military courage. And this is perhaps I'd gone into this imagining that courage was in some way a kind of lone wolfish quality. You know, it was singular, it was solitary, it was maverick in some way. And the military gave me the clearest example of the extent to which the very opposite is true. So the extent to which courage is very often the product of a collective state of mind. And so I talked to a whole range of young infantrymen going out to Afghanistan. And it was very, very clear to me that through what they said, that it was a sense of responsibility to their mates, responsibility to their friends, that way above any kind of ambition or even kind of obedience, that sense of responsibility to their mates was how and why very ordinary young men and women, because I spoke to a handful of female medics who are right there on the front line with their male counterparts. So it's how ordinary young men and women are rendered capable of really extraordinary things. So I think if there were one lesson for me to come out of the time that I spent with the military, it was that sense of quite how powerful that kind of collective courage can be.
You had mentioned at the start of the interview that although people might think of you as a courageous and brave person, that you don't actually feel that way necessarily on the inside. Do you think that is true of most people that we think of as brave? And did you ever ask that question of the people that you talked to, especially the World War II veterans and the soldiers in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, the soldiers, I didn't speak to any World War II veterans. I did speak to some people who'd been through more recent wars, like the Iraq War, and I spoke to a very prominent ex-Special Forces soldier in from British Forces, who'd served for a long time. But that sense of, you know, I don't feel brave on the inside. It's interesting. It varied to some extent across the range of people I spoke to. So, but I was surprised by the sheer number of people who said things like, "I wasn't brave. I had no choice," or "I wasn't brave. I was just doing my job," or other people might say, "I was just doing what anyone in my situation would have done." That wasn't brave. So what was very fascinating was the extent to which lots of my interviewees felt to some extent uncomfortable with being called, you know, with this big fine word, bravery, being attached to them. And I think it was a very strong thread that came through many, many of the conversations I had, really almost right across the board, that bravery exists in the telling as well as in the doing. So it's although there might be, there was one really incredible woman I spoke to who dug survivors out after a terrible earthquake in Bam in Iran in 2003. This was an English woman who was traveling there at the time, just found herself in this situation, you know, and where many or most people you would imagine would be immobilized by being in a situation where the entire city had collapsed. This woman, Ruth Millington, dug people out of the dust with her hands over a period of 11 hours. And she and another man, a close friend of hers that she was with, they saved 7 lives that day. And so I'd said to her, you know, I'd asked her how she weighed what the outside world has read as her courage. And she said, oh, well, I don't call it brave. You know, I would do the same thing tomorrow. But what was so fascinating, even though she doesn't call herself brave, we do. And we're right to do so. So I think there's this fascinating kind of mismatch and slight, you know, the respect in which courage resides in the importance we place on these stories and on sharing these stories and in raising these people, you know, the great deeds of these people up. That is to some extent where this kind of noble ideal comes from.
Have you noticed any differences or trends among men versus women in the way they approach their fears or the way they overcome them and find it within them to be courageous?
That's such a fascinating question. I mean, I went into this very much wondering whether I was going to find a feminine form of courage and a masculine form of courage. And while I would say that perhaps among men and perhaps particularly boys, there may be an expectation of certain levels of kind of playground bravery. And there might be a greater expectation of boys being brave, you know, I don't know, climbing a tree, skateboarding down a steep hill. There may be a greater weight of expectation on them than their female counterparts. But when one actually looks at the courageous acts of men and women, the mechanisms of overcoming are remarkably similar. And so in the end, I really struggled to find a kind of different quality to female courage than to that of men. You know, I suppose I would say that it was one of the kind of key discoveries for me was the extent to which courage is not about kind of muscle and balls. You know, it's not about muscle. It's a quality of mind and of temperament, as much as it's a quality of kind of brute strength, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And that very sort of strongly reinforced for me this idea that male and female courages are not so very different, and that the quality we're looking at is a quality that is human rather than superhuman.
You also talked to a survivor of a massacre in Kosovo. Could you tell her story and what it tells us about bravery?
Well, hers is a really extraordinary story. I first met her, in fact. Very shortly after the war, and she was living in a small town in the south of Kosovo, as with a kind of large extended family network there, and just after the commencement of NATO bombing, the kind of Serbian paramilitary units in that area had reacted with extraordinary violence, and she had been part of a truly horrific massacre, which took place in just a couple of hours, in which 49 members of her extended family were killed, including her husband and two of her children. You know, the men were shot against the back wall of a house. The women and children were corralled into a cafe and then basically had rounds fired. It's a truly horrific story. She was loaded onto the dead bodies after this massacre were loaded onto a truck to be carried off to the mass graves that were then excavated by UN war crimes investigators some months later. But she and her one surviving son managed to survive by playing dead amongst this kind of tangle of rectangular bodies on this mm-hmm. on this lorry, and they rolled off the lorry and managed to hide for the rest of the war. And so I'd met her family very shortly after the war, when it was all very fresh and excruciatingly painful aftermath for them. But then I went back there 12 years later while I was working on this book, because what I was curious about was the kind of long-term courage. So there was this moment of courage that meant she leapt off the lorry with her son and she saved both their lives. But then there's living with that horror, really, and those memories. And she wasn't really... It's the darkest story I have ever encountered as a journalist. And yet the kind of light at the end of the story is among the most uplifting I've ever come across, because the thing that kept her going and has kept her going through these 12 years is her love for this surviving son. And when I went and met her, he'd just gone off to university, and she said, "Oh, you will wait." We'd done the interview, and she said, You will wait for Gramos, won't you? I really want you to see him." And, you know, the last time I'd seen him is a little pretty traumatized 8-year-old boy. And in walked this great big, tall, handsome 20-year-old guy, just back from university, and her very pain-racked face exploded in this huge smile, and she gave him this huge hug. And in that simple family mother's love, I saw an extraordinary source of human strength and human courage, and it ended up offering this really rather inspiring and uplifting moment at the end of a story that was inhuman in so many other ways.
Well, Polly, you've shared with us some really heroic stories here. Many of us may never have the opportunity to show our courage and bravery in this way, but what are some ways you think we could do so in our everyday lives? And we only just have a minute left.
Yeah. So in these, I suppose the key thing I found was that often apparently humble, almost invisible, small braveries have far more in common with these apparently epic acts of courage than people might think, and that lots of the mechanisms for overcoming, whether you're overcoming some huge threat or whether you're overcoming a small fear, lots of the mechanisms of overcoming those fears are the same. And so that I hope that in some of these stories, and there are some large stories and there are some very small stories, I hope there may be something to inspire some of us about smaller ways in which we might be able to face up to our fears and live our lives to the full.
Well, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Great to meet you.
That was Polly Moreland. Her new book is The Society of Timid Souls, or How to Be Brave.
Coming up, author Patrick Rothfuss joins us for this week's Geek Out segment to talk about whether women are welcome in the worlds of comics, science fiction, other hotspots of the worlds of geekery. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. The news is next, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.